also Alana J. Smith.
Daniel V. Smith, I'm excited.
You should be. Welcome back to Dan Has a Plan, Beyond the Balance Sheet.
We're back.
I'm Daniel B. Smith, a financial advisor on the Family Wealth Management team at UBS Financial Services. Our branch is located in Paramus, New Jersey, and I can be reached at daniel.b.smith@ubs.com. I'm joined by my daughter, Alana J. Smith.
Hello, hello.
Our guest today is Sarah Paradiso. She is a veterinarian and medical director at Hamilton Animal Care. She's not affiliated with UBS Financial Services, and her views are her own.
Fantastic. Okay, so we're about to talk all things pets today.
And there's a lot going on with pets.
Money-wise, you mean?
Money-wise, everything-wise. I talk to clients a lot about their pets.
Yeah.
And I basically ask them three questions, or I have three tips when they're considering a pet or even if they have one. The number one thing is pet insurance. Let me repeat, pet insurance.
Yeah, you don't want to go without it.
Yes. Secondly, I recommend that they have a good pet sitter.
Well, wait, go back to pet insurance. Like, how much does a policy cost generally?
Well, policy costs are wide-ranging, and there's many providers out there now, but it's usually an economical amount of money to spend on a monthly basis to offset the costs of future pet emergencies.
Right, maintenance.
Could be diagnostic, it could be surgery, could be a myriad of things.
Okay, cool. Going on to pet sitters.
Pet sitters are important because pet sitters allow us to have a life without our pet, right? We worry about pets just like children, and we want to have a good, reliable person that will love them and care for them just as we would. Well, that's paramount. People have weddings, they have graduations, they want to fly to the Bahamas for a week.
Yeah.
Can't do it unless you have a good pet sitter.
True.
And thirdly, strongly suggest that you connect with a good veterinarian. Even if you have a pet already, call them, ask questions, and find the right fit for your pet.
Right, yeah. You know, not one size fits all.
Yeah, those are three things that I think are paramount. Insurance, respite care, and a good vet.
Yeah, awesome. Are you speaking from personal experience?
I am. So I'm going to tell a brief story about our dog, Leo.
Oh, yeah. The famous Leo.
I would be hard-pressed to ask any client of mine that doesn't know the name of Leo, our pet.
Well, yeah, you said you worry about your pets like you worry about your kids. Would you rank Leo the same as me, Ben, and Janine?
Well, of course.
Yeah. Okay, good answer.
Very good answer. Because this will be listened to by one
Susan Smith.
Correct.
Yeah, go on.
So we got Leo from a very reputable breeder. Sue researched diet. She researched veterinarians. We got pet insurance up front, and Leo came home. And just a few short weeks into his new residence, Sue noticed on a walk that he was dragging his hind quarters. Mm-hmm. It was a bit of paralysis. Sue, being a physical therapist, brought Leo to our veterinarian, and right away he had to have an MRI, which is, of course, very expensive, covered by pet insurance. And secondly, the MRI revealed that he had an impingement in his neck area, which was causing paralysis. It was not going to be a good outcome unless he had surgery. Mm-hmm. So Leo had surgery, another very large cost covered by pet insurance. So did I mention pet insurance?
Yeah, I know Mom has talked about how it's better than human insurance.
Correct. The bottom line, it allowed us to focus on the care of Leo and his recovery.
Yeah.
And I believe our family is a very good pet owner family, but my wife is a superstar pet owner.
She is, yes.
Yes. So he's on a very strict diet. He's on a very strict exercise regimen, but he provides so much joy to not only Sue, but our entire family that it's worth the input that she provides. And it's been a good experience. So the three things I mentioned as tips, the insurance and a good veterinarian, have been covered. What we're looking for, and we do have a couple of people that do sit for Leo, is that pet sitter.
Yeah, you're looking for a full-time pet sitter? You throwing it out there?
I'm saying it. Okay. I'm not sure my wife agrees with it.
Oh, boy. We love to stir the pot on this podcast.
Certainly do. But anyways, Leo is, he's a joy to be around as a pet. And he's really, I wouldn't want to call Leo a pet. He's really a member of the family.
Yeah, he is, no doubt. So. All right, let's get it started with Sarah Paradiso.
The Sarah Paradiso.
Excuse me, the Sarah Paradiso. All right, tell us how you got into your field, Sarah.
Yeah, it's always an interesting journey for every vet. I feel like the easy answer is, oh, I love animals. But that's not really where it comes from. You have to love medicine, you have to love science, and you have to love people. So many people think, oh, I go into vet med because I don't like people. And no dog has ever come in alone. They always come in with someone. So I love medicine. I love surgery and I love animals. And so vet med was the easiest way to combine all of that.
Yeah, sounds like it.
That's why she's in the world. So taking a step back with people owning pets, I like to get into the pre-owning stage. So is there any guidance you would give someone when they're trying to choose a pet?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think it really depends on your lifestyle. And you have to think about that before you think about what kind of pet you want, even what kind of breed you want. If you're talking dogs, a Labradoodle isn't for everyone. They're high energy dogs. If you're a low energy family, you want a St. Bernard. You want something like that. Versus if you're not home all the time, get a cat. And you want even lower maintenance, get a goldfish. You know, we can go anywhere in that spectrum, but you really just have to set your expectation and know that it is a time commitment and a financial commitment. And you need to be prepared for both of those.
And once you do choose the pet of your choice, whether it's cat or dog or maybe something exotic, is it good policy for them to ask the veterinarian, what is the normal health cycle of a dog? Kind of how long do you expect them to live? What are some of the hot buttons for that particular breed? You know, that type of thing.
Yeah, I wish people would do that because we have certain breeds that have certain health issues that we can expect. And it's hard when people get a breed that is known for a classic health issue, and then they're totally caught off guard and totally surprised when that health issue actually arises. When if we sat down and had that conversation ahead of time, we would be prepared and do some things maybe to even avoid having a flare of whatever that certain disease is.
Yeah, one of the things I've noticed too is that people have multiple pets. Are some breeds better as kind of a solo practitioner? or, you know, any you can identify that say two or three are better than one?
Depends on your lifestyle. Cats are much better in groups. I think cats do better in pairs compared to dogs can definitely be a solo adventure. Dogs just respond differently. When you have one dog, they very much bond to the owner versus when you have two dogs, they bond to each other. And so it depends on what you're looking for. If you're looking for your best friend, get one dog. If you get two, they will be best friends. They will not be your best friend.
Fascinating. And also that can kind of coincide with finances too. Like if you end up with a dog who has some maybe separation anxiety, you might not be able to leave them alone and you might be paying for dog sitters more than you would maybe two dogs who are entertaining themselves. Is that right?
Correct. Yeah, it could backfire and they could absolutely hate each other. But sometimes I have clients coming in saying, hey, I'm actually getting a dog for my dog. And that helps sometimes.
How important is exercise for pets?
Very, very. We have an obesity problem in cats and dogs. There's no doubt about that. We can joke about it because a fat French bulldog is adorable, but that causes health issues. And a lot of people think, oh, I can just take them outside to go to the bathroom, but they need to be active. And depending on the type of dog breed you have, that activity requirement is going to vary.
You know, our personal pet, we do multiple small meals a day, but does it depend on the breed as far as food frequency?
Yeah, most dogs are fed twice a day, but we definitely have some dogs that need more frequent meals, and that also depends on what their GI tract is like and if they have any weird dietary restrictions, that type of thing.
So when you've identified the breed you want, is it more advisable to go to a good reputation breeder? Is it word of mouth? What are some of the good practices about where to go to obtain a pet?
Yeah, that's a rabbit hole for sure.
Well, coming from your perspective.
Yeah, there's so many poor breeders out there, and I think that that's ruining the breed standard for a lot of breeds. But I think the number one resource for getting and finding a good breeder is the AKC website. If you're looking for a purebred dog, the American Kennel Club is the website you want to be looking at. You
okay.
want to be looking at what breeders are actively breeding, what breeders are actively showing, and how involved they are in their breeder community.
Mm. All right. Just because I've been experiencing this with a lot of my clients, a lot of their pets are having dental problems.
Mm.
Okay. So other than brushing their teeth, what can you do for dental care?
Right. Because like down the line, if it becomes a thing, then it's like we're talking about putting the dog out, right, to get it clean. And that's a whole finance expense.
Yes.
But imagine if you didn't brush your teeth.
Right. Yeah.
If you didn't brush your teeth for 2 years, your teeth would be garbage. And so we need to treat our teeth like that too. Brushing the teeth every other day is the number one way to prevent unwanted dental procedures. But on the contrary to that, when we look at, we go to the dentist every 6 months and they are able to scale and polish our teeth, take x-rays while we're away. No dog is going to let you put an x-ray probe in their mouth without biting it, you know? And so those dental procedures are not, there's nothing that you can do to avoid those 100%. Brushing is your number one bet. Other than that, we talk about greenies, dentist sticks, those types of chew type toys that we can use to help decrease the tartar formation.
Are there certain shots that a puppy should be getting or that are kind of part of the protocol? Like, you know, when our mom or dad took us to the pediatrician, we had, you know, for me, we'd got the polio vaccine and smallpox and all that stuff. Because I'm not aware of the terminology. What is it in your field that you recommend for your standard dog?
Great question. And I think every dog varies a little bit. So it's always good to consult with your veterinarian directly to develop a personalized plan. But if we're talking your generic dog, along the East Coast, there's three core vaccines in dogs. So one is a rabies vaccine. That one's required by law. So we can't ever get around that one. Number two is a distemper combo vaccination. So that one is kind of like a 4-in-1, 5-in-1 type of vaccine that protects against a lot of different types of intestinal disease, neurologic disease, respiratory disease, all rolled into one vaccine. That's a big, big core vaccine in dogs. And then number three, third core vaccine, which has become more popular, is a Bordetella vaccine. People call it the kennel cough vaccine, which is just a terrible name for it because we see that respiratory disease all over the place. You don't have to be in a kennel for that. So in the past 2 years, that's really been a push to make that one of our core vaccines. And then we have three different lifestyle vaccines, at least along the East Coast. Out West, you have a couple others that you can talk about, just depending on what your exposure looks like.
I've heard this new technology where a chip can be put into a dog to track it. Am I just so far behind the times that I'm the first to hear of this? Or
maybe.
Do you have experience with it?
Common misconception there, Dan. Common misconception. You're not the only one. I get a lot of clients asking about that. So very commonly, we will microchip animals. Those microchips have absolutely no tracking ability to them. They only are linked to a 16-digit code. That 16-digit code is put into a database that, let's say your dog gets lost. They scan your dog for a microchip. That number pops up, they plug it into a database system, and immediately all of your information is going to pop up. So they can pick up the phone and say, hey, Dan, we found your dog.
I wish I had that for my shoes. Sarah, I have a question. So as a pet owner yourself, when you're thinking about adopting or going down the pet route, what are the financial things to consider when you're starting from zero and you're like, I've never cared for a pet before? What are going to be the expenses?
Great question. You're going to be dealing with just your wellness visits. Those are things that we can expect. We have our expected and we have our unexpected costs. Your wellness visits can, depending on what area of the country you're in, can run you anywhere from $200 to $500 to $600 a year. You have to be prepared for those. Those are your non-optional visits. And then we need to be prepped for any type of emergency. No one's ever planning for their puppy to swallow a shock hole and need to get surgery to pull that out.
Yeah.
And for those who do have pet insurance, do you find that most practices accept it as a form of payment?
It depends. So pet insurance is a little bit different than human health insurance with any type of insurance plan that you have. So any provider, there's a ton out there now. What happens is you still have to pay your veterinarian everything upfront. So let's say, use as an example, your dog swallows a sock, needs a $4,000 surgery. You're still going to be paying your veterinarian everything up front, and then you submit your claim directly to your insurance company, and the insurance company will reimburse you based on whatever your plan looks like. I think the future of veterinary medicine will have insurance directly at hospitals, but we're not there yet.
I know I'm going deep into the woods on this one, but...
Oh, boy.
How similar is the anatomy of a standard dog to that of a human?
Yeah, this is good because she's a surgeon.
Yeah.
It's not that far off. I mean, I've never done surgery on any humans, but everything, we have all the same parts. They're in a different orientation. We don't walk on all fours, but we have the same intestinal tract. We have all the same bones and organs, just in different locations.
So one of the things I've heard recently is that a client of mine had a lab and it had an ACL surgery. Is that correct?
Speaking as an ACL surgery.
I mean,
Survivor?
I've had an ACL surgery and it wasn't any fun. So are we doing ACL surgeries seriously?
Very seriously. That's the number one orthopedic injury that we see in animals, in dogs. We technically call it a CCL in dogs, the cranial cruciate ligament, as opposed to an ACL in people, but it's the same surgery. Or I guess I can't say same surgery. I don't know how they do it in people, but it's the same injury, I should say.
When you complete the surgery and it's successful, what happens from the time the pet wakes up? How does that pet rehab from that surgery?
I wish we had physical therapy. We really just don't have that in veterinary medicine just yet. I think in the future we will. There are specialists that are aiming and going in that direction. We just don't have it. And so a lot of that falls on the owners and keeping in communication with your vet as to what your exercise requirements should be, or I should say restrictions, and taking it slow and easy, because that, as you know, is a hard surgery to recover from. And we just expect dogs to, hey, here's some pain meds and wake on up and walk around the next day. But they need that support. It's a big surgery.
One of the big costs of owning a pet is grooming.
The cost varies depending on, one, the animal, two, the owner.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it depends on the breed too, because like some breeds don't need to be groomed. If you're looking at a short-coated dog, they don't need regular grooming. Yes, they need a bath every once in a while, but I'm not noticing anything on physical exam that would say, hey, you need to get them into a groomer. Whereas when we're talking about the huge broom and doodles, all of our poodle mixes, those dogs need extremely regular grooming. I'm talking every 4 to 6 weeks, they need to get in. And that's very apparent when I see that they're not doing that. We see a ton of matting on those guys, and that's painful. People don't think of it as painful, but it truly is for them.
Is there a daily regimen you recommend for a pet? You know, brushing the hair, whatever, however short or long it is, cleaning their paws if they go out for frequent walks. Are those normal things that we should be doing?
Once a week, you should definitely get a good brushing in on your dog. That's going to help prevent any knots from forming, any mats from forming. Washing their feet when they're muddy, but they're not sterile creatures. You know, they do a good job grooming themselves a little bit with that too. But if it's muddy out, if it's wet out, keeping them dry is key. Once we start to get moisture in between their toes and in their coat, that's when we start to see some issues.
Sarah, what would you say is the most expensive animal to own?
A French bulldog.
Just medically?
Just about right there.
Yeah, French bulldog, 100%. They have so many health issues.
Oh, sure. Wow.
Breathing's number one, isn't it?
Yep. And there's a ton of surgeries and issues associated with that. Yes. I mean, of course, you can get into horses. Obviously, you have a huge expense just because they're so large. But if we're talking cats, dogs, and those types of things, French bulldogs again and again.
Wow.
How do you consult regarding diet for a dog?
Talk with your veterinarian about what diet would be recommended directly for your pet, because there are people that are trained to make pet food. And we make recommendations based on the companies that have veterinary nutritionists on them. So it's not just someone who decided, hey, one day I want to make pet food. It's someone who went to school for 8 years to be a vet, then someone who studied an additional 4 years just in animal nutrition to be able to make that food for them.
Wow, I had no idea that was a job. That's amazing.
What about vitamins? Are they popular?
I think you need to consult directly with your vet about what's best for your pet in that instance. But most of the time, if they're on a well-balanced, good commercial food, they don't need any vitamins, minerals, anything like that added to their food.
One of the things I do when I do financial plans now, and people have pets, I put them in the financial plan as, you know, a dependent.
Yeah.
Because they are, right? And I also am starting to do what are called little emergency funds for pets. So realistically speaking, how much money would you say you should set aside for emergencies just to have on hand if something were to happen?
I think $10,000 is a really good number to reach for. That's going to cover most emergency surgeries and emergency procedures that you would need. Yes, I'm hoping you're not pulling your wellness and those routine ear infections, that kind of thing from it. But if you have $10,000 set aside to be able to use in case of emergency, that would be perfect.
Okay.
Great.
And as far as, and I'll probably say it wrong, but spay or neutered, do you recommend that for most dogs and cats?
Most definitely. There's a lot of unwanted health risks if you don't spay or neuter your pets. And so timeline can vary depending on the size of the animal and what health issues we want to prevent or avoid. But spaying or neutering is hands down one of the healthiest things that you can do for them.
Oh, why is that?
Yeah,
great question. So one of the biggest surgeries that we end up doing in emergency is something called a pyometra surgery. And so a pyometra is when your uterus fills up with pus and it becomes an emergency surgery very quickly. It's not something, hey, we wait until the next day. That's okay, we're going to surgery right now. And the surgery for that is to spay them. But it takes what would be a routine spay and turns it into an emergency surgery that typically quadruples the cost of what you would be paying if you would have just spayed your dog ahead of time.
Wow.
People are allergic to dogs and cats. Are there some breeds that are just more, that are not allergic to people, or does it really just depend on the person?
Depends a lot on the person. I think the hype of all of the poodle crosses has faded pretty quickly now that people realize they're not as hypoallergenic as people once thought. They're better for some people, but not always. And so it really depends on the person and what part you're allergic to. You could be allergic to the dandruff, you could be allergic to the fur, you could be allergic to the saliva. So depends on the person.
So one of the classic statements I've heard my whole life is, my dog is so smart. All right. I want to know, are dogs smart?
Lucky, because mine is not. They take a lot of work. They take a lot of work to make them smart. They want to learn, but you have to put that work in. They're so food motivated. So a lot of, you look at a Labrador will do anything for a cookie. But you got to put the work in to do that. Yes, they have an inherent willingness to learn, but you have to shape that. If you don't put in that kind of time, your dog's not going to be well behaved.
I have a charity and we did a charitable event where we raised money to purchase a dog that can sense when the blood sugar level of a diabetic was in danger.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. How does that happen? How does a dog know when someone's blood sugar is in a danger zone?
Yeah, their nose. Their nose is so, so powerful. So their olfactory bulb, which is what we use to smell with, is, and I don't know the exact statistic, but just wildly stronger than what we have. So they're able to detect those in just the pheromones that you're secreting. And it's incredible. They have to learn a lot to be able to do that. You're not going to get a normal dog and all of a sudden say, oh yeah, you can tell when that's happening. They have to go through extensive training to be able to do something like that.
Yeah, something I was going to ask about support dogs in general. How is the cost elevated for those?
Honestly, I don't know if I can speak a ton on that since I haven't worked directly with them, but I know a lot of training goes into those in the first half. They have to be a very well-bred animal. You're not going to get a poorly bred animal to do something like that. And then they have to go through a year of training with a trainer before they can even get to you for those types of things. That's taking out emotional support animals. I think that's a whole different class. We're talking truly working animals that are true service animals, go through such rigorous training. And typically they're very healthy animals because they're bred to be extremely healthy. So I wouldn't expect any like undue diseases or anything with them, but they definitely go through a lot of training ahead of time.
Right.
Yeah. These next couple of questions are a little bit disturbing, but I feel that they should be asked because you're a professional. So let's just say I'm in the park and I see a pet owner mistreating a pet. Is there a non-confrontational protocol to report that?
Yeah, I'd reach out to your local law enforcement directly first. I always tell people, don't go right up to them. You don't know what's going on with them directly, and I don't want anyone to get hurt. And a lot of law enforcement chapters will have an animal welfare, animal cop type division that can walk you through that.
On the flip side of that, let's say circumstances change with a family. They no longer can properly care for a pet. Mm-hmm. Is there a humane process to disengage from being a pet owner?
Yeah, don't be afraid to ask for help. I think that's what so many people struggle with and why so many animals end up being neglected, because they're ashamed to say, hey, I made a bad decision and I need help. That's why we have rescue groups. That's why we have shelters. And it's so much healthier for the animal and kinder to the animal to just admit defeat and say, hey, this isn't for me, and bring them to a shelter, bring them to a rescue. That's so much better than saying, hey, I can't do this, and I'm just going to keep putting it off. Reach out to those types of organizations or even directly to your veterinarian and see if they have an outlet or a rescue group that they work with that can help rehome that animal.
Yeah, like you were saying before, of folks who misinterpret what kind of energy level a dog might have. I was out in LA and I happened to go to an ASPCA and there were a bunch of huskies. And the friend I was with, who's super in tune with animals, was saying that, you know, a lot of people will buy Christmas presents and it's a cute puppy and huskies are such cute puppies, but they're needy and they take a lot of energy and need a lot of care, and they can jump a 6-foot fence like it's nothing. And it's hot in LA and they have thick coats. So a lot of them end up in the shelters.
You're 100% right. Those are a very demanding breed, and no puppy should be a Christmas gift. That has to be a family decision that everyone's on board with, because it's all fun and games when they're a cute puppy. But when they grow into a 80-pound dog, we all need to be prepared to care for them.
When our pet owners have to part ways with their pets at the end of their lives, are there any support groups that you recognize or any recommendations you give them for how to mourn?
It's hard. I think it's different for every person. Some large animal hospitals will have social workers on staff. Those typically are in your emergency hospitals or any academic type hospitals. So if you're looking at like a university that has a veterinary school in it, those have some nice outreach support group. But talk to your family too, because you're not in something like that alone. No one wants to go through that. It's for a lot of people like losing a family member. So just reach out and ask for help and see who can support you through that.
And with the practice that you work at, I can only give you a personal experience. Like, we have a King Charles Cavalier, and our dog Leo has a neurologist. So there are veterinary animal hospitals, and then there are basically veterinarians. Can you explain the difference for people?
Great question. I think it's confusing because it's a lot different than human medicine. Yeah, human medicine, you have a specialist for everything. The fun part about veterinary medicine is, as a general practitioner, I get to dabble in all of the specialties. I get to be a dentist. I get to do some light cardiology work. I get to be a surgeon. I get to be your general practitioner that gets to do your vaccines and see the fun puppy visits. So I always recommend that you touch base with your veterinarian directly first to see what they're comfortable with. Every veterinarian is going to have a different level of how comfortable they are with different things. Some vets absolutely love surgery and can handle those types of emergency cases. My preference is always to reach out to your vet directly first, because they know your dog or cat. When you're going out to an emergency hospital or a big hospital with specialists, they don't know who you are just yet. And yes, there's a time and a place for them, but your vet may be able to handle something like that. And then if they can't, they can direct you to someone that they would recommend to deal with something a little bit more complicated, like an oncologist for chemotherapy or an ophthalmologist for a wild eye case, something like that.
Dan, do you want to ask one final question about an aha moment?
Yes. So I've been doing this, and you know, when I work with my clientele, I always have some aha moments. I call it once a week, at least I have one. What is an aha moment for Sarah Paradiso, veterinarian?
We get those small victories a lot where, you know, we're able to save lives, and I'm able to do that weekly, you know, and that's, so I don't think there's one moment I can pinpoint that says, hey, yeah, I made such a difference, because to be honest, it happens often, and it's really rewarding when you get this animal that can barely walk coming in. You find out they actually have a large splenic mass that's been bleeding into their abdomen. You quickly triage the patient and get them prepped for surgery. And then you see them back for their suture removal 2 weeks later, and they're happy as a clam, giving you kisses on your face. And that's why I got into this field, because I can make that happen regularly.
So it sounds like when you go to work, it's really not work.
Nope, I absolutely love what I do.
The clock goes by quick, I'm sure.
It sure does. Well, and it's busy days, busy days.
Yeah.
Yeah, and before you go, just tell people out there before you go, how long is the education process to become a vet?
Good question. It's 8 years for most general practitioners. So 4 years of undergraduate and then 4 years of veterinary school. Specialists will go on for an additional 4 to 6 years on top of that. So Dan, your neurologist went to school for an additional 4 to 6, even after the original 8.
Wow. That's all we have to say.
Thank God for you guys.
Yeah.
Sarah, appreciate your time. It was lovely talking to you.
Thank you guys for having me on.
Alana J. Smith.
Daniel V. Smith.
Love you.
Love you.
This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services Incorporated offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services Incorporated is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.